Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today are a pair of star-crossed movie lovers. We have the author of the ongoing essay series, A Year with Kate, and firm shark partisan, Anne-Marie Kelly.
Hi.
And the editor and founder of ClassicFilmFan.com, and a jet all the way, Carrie Specht.
Until my dying day.
Yes.
Hello.
On today's episode, we're continuing our series on movie musicals. This time, Anne-Marie is going to pitch Robert Wise's West Side Story for the FlixWise favorites list. Will our panel find a time and place for Tony and Maria on our list? Or are we going to have a rumble? Anne-Marie, choose your weapon. Will it be bottles, knives, or guns? Let's find out. Alright, let's find out.
Okay. I wrote a not quite Lady P level introduction for it.
That's probably for the best.
What I've got is two gangs, both alike in indignity, in fair New York, where we lay our scene. From simmering racism break to new mutiny, where teenage blood makes teenage hands unclean. In the mid-1950s, Arthur Lawrence, Jerome Robbins, and Leonard Bernstein brought Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet to the streets of contemporary New York City and changed Broadway as it was known then. In 1961, Jerome Robbins and Robert Wise brought it to the screen. Through music, dance, and design, West Side Story tells the story of star-crossed lovers Maria and Tony caught on opposite sides of a turf war. The film would win 10 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. From the first lonely whistle overlooking the skyscrapers of Manhattan to the electrifying dance at the gym to the deadly quiet conclusion, West Side Story is a vibrant musical tragedy.
That was so concise. Mine just on and on.
I give you an A.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That was solid.
I used the prologue from Romeo and Juliet.
I saw that.
Eighth grade literature class. Yay! Finally comes into play.
Teacher said you would need it someday.
I know. Who knew, right?
Let's talk about West Side Story. I take it, is it one of your favorite musicals?
Yeah. Absolutely it is. It's
when did you first see it?
Very young. I saw it very young and actually was not prepared. Nobody had told me about the ending, so when Tony got shot... Oh, sorry, spoiler. It's okay, it's Romeo and Juliet. We all know how Romeo and Juliet dies, right? Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't prepared for the ending, so when Tony got shot, I leapt about, 8 feet in the air.
So you and had my not parents, read like, Romeo and Juliet yet?
No, I was 8.
Yeah.
I definitely hadn't read Romeo and Juliet yet, and I, leapt into my dad's lap, and my parents, I think, still feel, terrible for having wounded me as a small child through musical theater. But yeah, it's been a personal favorite for a while, but just beyond that, every time I watch it, it's one of those where I'm so familiar with it that I listen to it, I'm like, oh, this is beautiful, this is fantastic, and then I watch it and I go, oh no, it's actually a legitimately great movie.
Yeah.
So
it's more than just being a childhood favorite and having those memories of home and your first movie. It's much more than that.
Yeah, I mean, Hello, Dolly is a childhood favorite too, but it's not a movie where I rewatch it and go, yes, this is a brilliant cinematic masterpiece that shall live on forever. No offense to Barbara. So, yeah. What about you?
Oh, yeah, I think I saw it very young as well. I want to say I might have seen it on a TV broadcast because when I was young, there was no such thing as VHS, mm-hmm. which for those of you who don't know what VHS is, it came out before DVDs. I think I saw it on TV with commercials. I may have actually even seen it at a community college presentation before I saw the film version. So I was prepared for the storyline. Didn't realize it was Romeo and Juliet till I read Romeo and Juliet, and then went, hey, this is West Side Story, right? Mm-hmm. You just can't beat the cinematography, the direction, which, of course, is the great Robert Wise, who could do no wrong. Well, then there was Star Trek the movie, but we won't talk about that right now. but the music is just amazing. And even though we'll get into it a little bit later, some of the characters are maybe a little miscast, and perhaps their hairstyles are not exactly appropriate. And of course, they all look like they're 30-year-old teenagers. Mm. But other than that, I have to say I've always liked it. It's one of those films where once it starts playing, if I happen to turn on Classic Movies or any classic movie channel, and it's on, you get sucked in, mm-hmm. and you end up watching the whole thing.
Right.
My only problem with it is the fact that Natalie Wood can't sing,
nope.
you know, and somebody else sang for her.
Why didn't
she did an amazing job emoting as mm-hmm. if she was singing. But, yeah, we should give a shout-out to Marnie Nixon.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I believe she's still alive.
Yes. She is. She is still alive. She actually was touring with My Fair Lady as Mrs. Higgins.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's
singing
right.
behind the curtain. Right?
she was touring as Mrs. Higgins in My Fair Lady.
She gets to be herself. She gets top billing, or I guess that would be like fourth billing.
Right? I actually met her in person online at the Turner Classic Film Festival on the red carpet.
That's amazing.
I got to speak with her. Yeah, mm. She was there. I can't remember what the musical was, but the The King and I think was playing. Yeah. Of course, she was the voice for Deborah Carr.
She was the voice of Deborah Carr.
Singing voice, yeah.
Singing voice of Deborah Carr. Singing voice, obviously, of Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady,
mm-hmm.
and also the one high note or the few high notes that Marilyn Monroe sings in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Right, that's right.
Or also yes. Marnie Nixon.
Yes.
And then she's in Sound of Music.
Yeah. One of the nuns.
One of the nuns.
So long and perhaps underappreciated career in Hollywood.
She wrote a great book about it called I Could Have Sung All Night that you should definitely check out.
Oh, thank you for that.
But let's talk about, I don't even know where to start with this movie. There's a lot going on. Should we talk about our favorite performances? Let's talk about what we like about the movie, and then we can get to maybe some of the more problematic aspects. So,
well, I'll just start with Rita Moreno.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this was the role for her. I think she's still with us as well, mm-hmm. and amazing. She's still working. She just won the SAG Award, I think, the Lifetime Achievement Award, last year?
Yeah.
The year before?
So it's like EGOTs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the gal does have a Tony and a Grammy.
And an Oscar.
And an Oscar and an Emmy. So she's got it.
She's got
one of the few people that mm-hmm. has it, right?
Yep.
Well, Rita's one of these people who's been around for a very, very long time. In fact, a lot of people don't realize that she was in Singing in the Rain.
Mm-hmm.
She's the young flapper. And she's also in
Zelda. She's Zelda.
Yeah.
With the blonde hair.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Thanks, Zelda.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's her.
Wow.
Anytime, Dawn.
That's her.
That's her. And then she's also in The King and I.
Yep.
She's the young girl that's brought as a gift to the king.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, she's done a lot of other movies and television. She's mostly known for television. But her performance is just so spot on. And as the gal who's happy to be in America
mm-hmm.
and is happy to have left the poverty of her home and to find the possibilities in the U.S. And then the way she's treated in the storyline is perhaps for me one of the most gut-wrenching reversals of fortune
mm-hmm.
To make her become so angry
mm-hmm.
and actually hurt her friend with her anger in a very justifiable way. I'm not one for spoilers, so I'm not going to mention what it is that happens to her. You guys can.
I think we probably should talk about it a little bit because I think both sides are at least initially portrayed as they're adversaries, but they're both. I don't think there's a true villain in the film until you get to that scene. And I personally can't side with. I mean, I don't want to say I side with anyone, but
mm-hmm.
all of the Jets become pretty villainous.
Yeah, and basically we've mentioned that as Romeo and Juliet, but it's Hispanics against whites.
Right.
It's Puerto Ricans against whites. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
The children of the immigrants against the children of immigrants. It's something that they kind of slyly stick into the movie is that almost all of the Jets are first generation Americans,
mm-hmm.
Which is implied to be part of the reason why they're so against the Puerto Ricans. But yes.
Which is traditional America. The last immigrants always are the ones who hate the next immigrants.
Yes.
Right. Because it's the whole fighting over jobs situation.
Mm-hmm. Which is a surprising bit of social commentary in a musical. And part of the reason why I love the musical is that it's very naive in a lot of the ways that it portrays way it portrays street violence. But at the same time, it's one of the first musicals to do that. I mean, certainly one of the first movie musicals to go after that. And yes, after the scene in the candy shop where her character gets manhandled, to put it nicely.
And of course, the film doesn't blatantly tell you or show you there's the implication. But adults will get it.
I certainly didn't pick up on it the first time I saw the movie.
I did not.
But now watching it, it's impossible to ignore.
It's the difficulty of the movie in general is that after that happens to her and after Maria has Tony literally die in her arms and the movie just kind of ends on this very somber and quiet note, which I think is the right way for it to go out. I don't think a song would be particularly well placed after the body count has risen to the extent that it has. But it's difficult to believe that the movie ends and then everybody, like this one death has changed everything for everybody because there are too many personal vendettas that have been created where no personal vendettas were before. Like you said, it's animosity, but it's never personal animosity before that point.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Nobody's been personally wounded by what's happened until people actually start dying.
Right.
Well, and I think in a way it sort of, you start with this kind of nice, sweet musical and then as the movie matures, it goes on in time, it matures and it brings the audience along with it. So that sweet, cutesy little rival gangs things becomes very serious street violence. Mm-hmm. And so that bravado of, oh, my group's better than yours, turns into those personal vendettas. And you realize for all the characters, everything's gotten very, very real. Mm-hmm. Beforehand, it was just sort of a posturing. But now it's like, oh my gosh, our actions actually have results. Mm-hmm. And we've kind of put ourselves in a place now that we can never turn back. We cannot return to that innocent time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And in terms of design and in terms of direction, one of the really great things that happens is the first half of the movie is very colorful, and then starting with the riot and starting with the brawl, it starts like the color starts sapping out of it, except associated with the lovers. Mm. There's still color when you see the lovers.
And glossy.
Yeah, it loses that kind of glossy, happy, bright, like the bright red of the gym.
Right. Mm-hmm. But it gets more dreamlike.
Yeah.
Soft focus.
Yeah. It loses that and it starts getting darker. Mm-hmm. It starts getting shadowier. And the scene "Cool" that the Jets sing, which actually in the play takes place before the brawl. But they move to after. I think it's brilliant that they move it to afterwards because it exactly encapsulates the tension and the fear and the growing paranoia that these guys are feeling now that, like you said, it's gotten real.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I don't know. I thought, now that you mentioned it, I don't know if it... I had sort of a problem with that "Cool" scene. It seemed like there was tension building and then all of a sudden we're stopping to do a "Cool" bit. There's something innately sort of silly about grown men. And these are grown men, even though they are playing teenagers, walking down the street, snapping rhythmically as they're trying to seem tough. And the movie is in many ways about, as you say, macho posturing. It's about masculinity and what it means to be a man. And I'm wondering how do you guys feel like that jives with all the twirling?
That's fine. I mean, who is that? This is actually co-directed. It's not just Robert.
Right. Robert Wise and Jerome Robbins. Jerome Robbins did all the choreography and actually shot "Cool" and the opening prologue and "America." And then because he was taking so long to shoot those, and they are, and certainly "America" and the prologue are the two most interestingly visual musical numbers in the movie. He was taking so long with them that they ousted him. But Robert Wise refused to allow his credit to slide.
And this is the first time in Academy history
that
two people were listed as the nominees and two people won as director.
It's true. Yeah.
And the movie owes a huge debt to Jerome Robbins. It would not be the same movie without him.
Right.
I don't think
Robert
Wise knows how to choreograph it.
Well, and he knew that. And that's why he had no problem with it, the name staying on.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. How to choreograph a dance and how to choreograph a camera. It's another active camera movie.
Right.
Camera angles change
that
a lot.
That whole first shot is a beautiful choreography coming in on the scene, going, okay. It's almost like saying, what tale are we going to show? What corner of New York? Oh, look, here's something happening here.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, bringing it in. Which is something Robert Wise would maybe not so subtly borrow for Sound
for
of Music for an exactly opposite reason.
Right.
But a helicopter shot into a single lone person doing one thing, admittedly spinning around on a mountaintop. But, you know, it's the same kind of idea, and it works great for both. It made an iconic scene for both. But.
Right, mm-hmm. Right, yeah. But that's pretty much the sole shot of the movie that was not made on the
soundstage.
On the soundstage.
The prologue's on location, but nothing else is. Everything else is on a soundstage.
Yeah.
Which it needs, because like you said, there is, when you're watching the prologue, and it's an incredible piece of dance for 5 minutes. It's probably the best 5-minute long dance sequence in terms of introducing character and plot and everything that is on film.
Yeah.
But it there is something you have to adjust your expectations a little bit when you see grown men suddenly break out into dance. I don't have to because I grew up with it and I think it's great, but I understand that there are people who have that issue.
The suspension of disbelief. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. If you're somebody who's watched these kind of movies as a kid, then it's more palatable.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think nowadays, if we try to introduce this to a younger generation, they're not going to get it without any kind of context of other movies. And perhaps if you're a parent or grandparent who does want to introduce this to your kids, you might want to show them some Disney films first and then switch over to something similar in live action and then go to this film.
Although the movie itself does that to a certain degree because the prologue builds. Like, they don't start out immediately leaping. They start with small little movements that then build into a larger dance.
Yeah, that's right.
But the movie and the musical just in general kind of walks this fine line between stylization and reality, because if it tips too far into one, it becomes a ballet or an operetta. If it's if it tips too far into the other, it becomes social commentary, and it's on shaky ground to be social commentary. Mm-hmm. So it walks dances this fine line, and it does it really well. And that's where it works best, is when it's kind of towing that. But it's beautiful. Yeah. it's a beautiful looking movie. It's a beautifully directed movie. And the color is just incredible in it, of those vibrant colors.
Well, I have to say, I don't think I've ever believed of any two people falling instantly in love at first sight as much as you believe Tony and Maria.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's a testament to how it's shot as much as the performances.
Yeah, their meeting at the gym, the entire gym sequence is great, but their meeting at the gym that suddenly isolates them and then brings them together in that dark kind of dream space that clearly is not of the gym, but is...
Right.
I don't know, the meeting of the minds, I guess.
Right. Mm-hmm.
this other space where they meet and they dance together and they fall in love. And you do believe it. It's very sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you guys think about Natalie Wood's performance? And how does this movie sort of play off of her persona?
Well, I mean, at the time, she was... This is 1961, right? Mm-hmm. The film was probably shot in 59, 60. She was the teen queen during that time, you know, a rebel without a cause. And,
right.
And I can't think of
Blunder in the Grass.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So she was just coming into making that transition into womanhood for roles. I do have a problem with her doing, for lack of a better term, brown face.
Right. Yeah.
And her accent.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, it just makes you wonder, okay, let me go step back to Broadway. You didn't have somebody on Broadway either playing it of proper nationality.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what to say about that. Audiences accepted it because she was such a big star.
Yeah.
And she's the only really big star of the movie.
That's
like, she's the only huge name
of the movie. Yeah, because Rita was not a big name yet.
But yeah, it's the difficulty of a movie that is trying to make comments on racism then succumbing to brownface.
Right.
In that of your three main characters who are Puerto Rican, only one of them is actually Latina. The other ones are Eastern European and Greek. And even the rest
close
of the gang members.
Yeah.
Yeah, close enough. And even the rest of the gang members, I think like two of them might be.
I mean, does that diminish your enjoyment of the pleasure of watching the movie? Or are you able to see past it?
I think obviously we were when we saw it. My question is, do audiences today? I mean, you know, we're so used to now people actually being cast in the proper ethnic, cultural, national, whatever word you want to throw in there, that it might be silly for somebody to see it and go, whoa, wait, why is this white chick acting like she has a Hispanic accent?
Right. But I don't think it's a caricature. She's not doing...
No, it seems respectful.
She's not doing a Cheetah Rivera
exactly,
accent.
Exactly, yeah.
She's not doing something extreme.
Exactly, yeah. No. It's not broad. It's still very subtle. The accent could probably use some work, but I don't think we should dismiss the performance completely just because there were some poor choices made early on. But nevertheless, I think this is one of her best performances. And
yeah, I have to agree. I'm not a huge Natalie Wood fan in general. I find her overrated.
Okay.
You know, she had a look.
Mm-hmm.
She could act. I don't think she was ever a tremendous actress.
Mm-hmm.
And she had her little tricks, that she, which she does not use in this movie, but she used to have this thing where she always tilted her head for this sort of comical or a curiosity effect. I did love her in Love with the Proper Stranger. That's a great film with Steve McQueen. Mm-hmm. Love it. But other than that, I can't really name a Natalie Wood film that I like. Well, that's a Natalie Wood film.
Okay.
She's in The Searchers, and I love The Searchers, but that's not a Natalie
that's
Wood
true.
Film.
Yeah.
I feel like they, you know, cast her mostly because she was such a big name, mm-hmm. and that white audiences would be more accepting of the film if there's a pretty white girl in the role.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Natalie Wood, for me, is kind of this a poster child for female sexual repression.
Have you seen Sex and the Single Girl?
No. I was just thinking of that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But, I mean, in Rebel Without a Cause and Splendor in the Grass, both of those movies, she's being harassed by her parents because she's growing up and she's becoming a
and she's having feelings.
I know.
And she definitely sleeps with Tony in this movie.
Oh, like, yeah.
It's yeah. not, it's a right. not so subtle implication. His right. shirt is off and they're
exactly.
both lying on bed together.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. don't they now say we are married now?
Right, basically? Yeah, it's their wedding night.
Yeah.
But I think this movie, again, is playing into that whole the budding sexuality thing and the, how protective Bernardo is of her. And she's going to reach out and to across the aisle and mm-hmm. fall in love with this white man.
Pollock.
Yeah, Pollock. God.
Yeah.
So I think in that way, she was effectively used, even if in some regard she was miscast. But then there's Richard Baymar. What do you guys think about him?
I actually love him.
You love him?
And it's like, for people who may not know the con, like, because it's like, oh, where did he go? What did he do? He was the dad in Sherry. He was in Twin Peaks.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was the dad of, what's her name? There's so many different Sherrys. He was the dad of the really sexualized girl. He wasn't the dad of Laura. He was the other dad
okay.
who he plays this really slimy character.
Oh, was it Lara Flynn Boyle's
yeah,
dad?
Yeah, no,
or
not
the other
one.
Girl.
The other one.
Oh, I don't remember.
But anyway, he plays this really slimy
yeah.
character.
Yeah.
I remember watching Twin Peaks, and I think I watched the whole season before I realized, oh my gosh, that's Tony.
Yeah.
You know, it's
and
like,
Russ Tamblyn's in Twin Peaks as well.
Yes.
Tony and Riff
yes,
back together
yeah.
again.
Yeah.
I love that.
I liked him a lot in this film. I thought he was kind of perfectly cast as sort of this all-American, although he's first generation, all-American kid who has no interest in girls and then is just swept away.
Yeah.
And because of his age and immaturity, having this sense of optimism that is completely misplaced.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's in love.
He looks like a Ken doll. Anybody?
He does, actually. He looks like a... Or no.
But in a
Ken's
good way.
Blonde.
Right?
It's, who's
in the best
who's
way.
The brunette? Eric. He looks like a
Eric
doll.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, there's a new one and he's brunette and his name is Eric, I
oh
think.
My goodness, I didn't know that.
But yeah, he definitely does have a well-scrubbed All-American look to him. And Baymar said that he wanted to play Tony much harder because they do say that he like started the Jets. So
right,
he's supposed
yeah.
to have had this violent past. But they wanted him to play this very scrubbed, sweet kid. And I think just by virtue of how, in another way, scrubbed and sweet Maria is, Natalie Wood as Maria is, like you need 2 points of innocence to come together because mm-hmm. as the kind of fulcrum that balances out the violence and awfulness that's happening.
Well, and
around.
Also the sexuality. If he wasn't as innocent as he was, then you would believe that he was taking advantage
yeah,
of her.
Yeah, you right, do need to right. believe that his intentions are pure.
Right. Yeah.
Otherwise, your rooting for them doesn't entirely work out.
Exactly. So let's talk about the influence of this film, its place in film history. In our Cabaret episode, we talked about, you know, classical Hollywood musical. This is something of a departure from that, as we mentioned, much darker themes. But what are some other ways in which this is a landmark film, this is a benchmark film?
I don't think you get to Cabaret without West Side Story
mm-hmm.
hmm.
because yeah, 3 years before West Side Story was Gigi. And that's like probably the dying gasp of the classical Hollywood musical, like the Arthur Freed
mm-hmm.
Hollywood musical. But in terms of bringing a story that has even an iota of social commentary to it, that starts to have a more dynamic, active camera to it, that's like trying and experimenting with new ideas, you don't get to Cabaret, you don't get to as dark and as messing with the genre as it is, you don't get to that without the stepping stone that is the experiment that was West Side Story.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good point. I think one of the reasons it was so popular at the time and won the awards was because of the darkness. And that was different. It's like, oh, wow, look what else we can do with musicals. It doesn't always have to be happy, happy endings and happy, happy world and everything works out in the end. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it sort of woke people up to sort of say there's more that you can do here. It's not a closed genre.
Yeah.
It's not going to be fixed. It can expand. Right. In fact, there's possibilities for it to expand beyond what we know of it today.
Yeah.
It just in terms of text, in terms of, you know, this is a musical with a body count. Yeah. Three people die.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And in terms of, it was musicals were comedies, especially mm-hmm. musicals on screen were comedies. Judy Garland falls in love with, you know, whoever. And by the end of the movie, she gets him. Mickey Rooney falls in love with usually Judy Garland. And by the end of the movie, he gets her. Fred Astaire falls in love with Ginger Rogers. And by the end of the movie, he gets her. There was a pattern to it. And there were exceptions, obviously. There's, you know, there's the Showboats and the South Pacifics of the world.
Depending on which version of Showboat
you see. Depending on which version of Showboat that you see. But for the most part, they followed this musical comedy idea. So to have a musical that not only is a tragedy, but has a high body count is a complete departure from that. And then also to have a musical that incorporates dance thematically into the story, as opposed to like American in Paris, where everything is, you know, there's a plot going on and there's music, there's songs that are pushing the story forward, but then everything stops so that there's this beautiful ballet in the middle of
that
it.
That has nothing to do
that
with
has
the
nothing.
Theme. Yeah.
And then it keeps going.
Right.
I mean, the part of the reason why I love the prologue to West Side Story so much is that it actually establishes everything for you. And dance is a really important part. The rumble is a balletic sequence. It's an incorporation of dance into it that became really important in the 70s. 70s musicals, things like Chorus Line, things like Chicago, things, basically everything Fosse did. Fosse was a choreographer first and director second. And I think he owes that like normalcy to West Side Story, coming in first and saying, this is something you can do.
Yeah. There's the door that is now open that wasn't open before.
All right, final question. Do we think it deserves entry to the FlixWise favorites list?
I say yes.
Yes?
I say yes.
All right. Done.
I'm really shocked that it isn't on the list.
Isn't that crazy?
One, along with Cabaret.
You're right. It just seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Indeed. I feel like it's one people underestimate. They think...
Well, I think people underestimate musicals in general.
Yeah, that's true.
They dismiss it with the happy-go-lucky comedies that you were talking about mm-hmm. before, which some of them are really quite amazing mm-hmm. and deserve to be on the list as well. Well, let's not dismiss that, which I don't think any of us are doing. But yeah, this one's like, what? Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Somebody has not... There are many people, cinephiles, who don't even watch musicals.
Right.
And it's like, well, how can you call yourself a cinephile if you're not watching all genres?
Right, yeah. And I'll admit to having underestimated this movie, and then I'll just pop it on at random times because I feel like singing Maria, and then I'll watch it like, this is gorgeous,
it's beautiful.
And it's so sharp.
And I do want to make one last plea: if at any point it's ever playing on the big screen, go see it on the big screen. I saw it in 70 millimeter at the Arrow a couple of years ago, and it completely changed how I saw the movie.
Yeah.
And it's a movie that I had on DVD, like I had the 50th anniversary DVD mm-hmm. collection, so I clearly watched it a lot. But it's like Lawrence of Arabia, like a lot of those big screen movies. It completely changes how you see the movie.
Well, right? And I'll go so far as to say, any chance you get to see any film on
True.
The big screen, you really should go. I saw North by Northwest and after it was restored at AFI. And I mean, there were parts I went, oh my gosh, I never noticed that was in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And it had an influence on the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. And also those films, before there was anything known as DVD and even television, they didn't necessarily think that their films would go to television, because usually only bad movies or quote-unquote bad movies went to television. They meant for you to see it on a big screen.
Yeah.
So at a certain films of a certain time period really should be seen on the big screen. I don't care how many times you've seen it before on TV, go and see it on the big screen.
Mm-hmm. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. If listeners want to have a clean fight about any of the matters we discussed on the show, they can meet us at sundown at FlixWise.com. And if anyone wants to join our gang, you can find us via Facebook and Twitter. But step one in the FlixWise initiation ritual is to rate us and leave us a glowing review on iTunes. anyone else feel like singing Gary Glitter?
That is amazing. I love your intro so much.
Oh, goodness. All right. On the next podcast, we're going to have our final entry in this series of musical episodes, with Carrie presenting the 1936 Fred Astaire musical Swing Time. Bring your top hat and tails, because it's going to be an elegant affair. That's for sure. Until then, Anne-Marie, thank you so much for bringing West Side Story to our attention.
Thank you.
Carrie, thank you for taking part in our panel.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Until we meet again, be cool.